wore his old jersey that he used to race in, so that was a little extra little thing to make it a little more symbolic.
A college student from Kodiak runs the mile in under 4 minutes. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Governor Parnell talks business development at a multi-state summit.
So as the Pinoir region, we will continue fostering economic opportunity together.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
Kodiak High School graduate Trevor Dunbar did something last night in Portland that no other Alaskan, not even his father, had ever accomplished. He ran a mile in under 4 minutes. His time of 3 minutes 59.06 seconds came in the Portland Rough Rider Twilight Meet. Dunbar told an interviewer from the running website FlowTrack that he was grateful to have runner Rob Finnerty pushing him.
I was just happy to have him, and then we could race it into the line, and hey, thinking I could run a little bit faster, but the goal was just sub-4, and I'm happy.
Finnerty, a runner for the Wisconsin Badgers, was just a third of a second behind Dunbar. Trevor's dad, Marcus, a longtime competitive runner and coach in Alaska, was there at the race to watch his youngest son set a mark that he had once dreamed of.
Well, it's been a long time coming. I made several attempts myself and came up short every time, so it's a vindication to have Trevor, especially since no Alaskan's ever done it. You know, I kind of wanted that to be me at one time, but there's been a lot of guys that came before me and guys that came after me, and we all came up short, but good to see Trevor getting it done.
For his part, Trevor honored his dad by wearing his old high school jersey in the meet.
Definitely a special one. I knew the season finale was going to be a special one, and I wore his old jersey that he used to race in, so that was a little extra little thing to make it a little more symbolic.
Dunbar will be entering his senior year at the University of Oregon this fall, where he competes in cross-country and middle-distance track. Hundreds of business and political leaders from Canada, Oregon, Washington, Montana, and Idaho have come to Alaska to talk about what these places all have in common. They're here for the Pacific Northwest Economic Region's annual summit being held at the Dena'ina Convention Center in Anchorage. And today, Governor Sean Parnell gave an address on the group's shared policy interests.
So as the Pinoir region, we will continue fostering economic opportunity together. We'll do it on a stronger foundation of public safety and education. We'll do it with infrastructure investment, tax and regulatory policy that makes sense, and we'll do it with regional cooperation.
The governor hit on a number of familiar themes. He talked about the importance of the Arctic, about federal overreach, and about lowering taxes as a way of encouraging business. Parnell also strayed from typical business topics to discuss the role public safety plays in an economy. He gave special attention to the state's campaign to curb violence against women, comparing the annual Choose Respect rallies coordinated by the state to the civil rights marches of the 1960s. Parnell also suggested that the J-1 visa program, which brings foreign students to the United States for cultural exchange and temporary work, is being targeted by human traffickers.
Before the employer realizes what is happening, these people, these representatives, haul off your foreign student employees and you don't know where they've gone.
The Pinoir Summit continues through Friday. Veteran senators averted what would have been a meltdown in Washington early this morning. Longtime legislators from both sides of the aisle agreed to defuse a confrontation that would have changed Senate rules. Joining us to explain what's happening and how Alaska fits into the puzzle is APRN's Peter Granitz. He joins us from the Capitol. Hi, Peter.
Hello, Lori.
Peter, just give us the overview of what the fight was over.
Senators had been arguing over the filibuster. That's a term that we've heard for forever, basically, since the beginning of the Senate. It basically gives a right to the minority to slow things down. The point of the Senate is that it's more deliberative than the House. The minority has a voice. They can actually slow things down. They have input. They are allowed to craft legislation with the majority. That's unlike the House, where 50% plus one wins. The fight today, or the fight over the past couple of days, has been over President Barack Obama's nominations to lead federal agencies. Majority Leader Harry Reid proposed changing the rules so that only 51 votes were needed to confirm presidential appointments to lead various agencies. The deal they reached today says that the two controversial picks to the National Labor Relations Board will be scrapped, but in return, the Republicans are promising they will allow votes on critical positions like the administrator of the EPA, the Department of Labor, and also the head of the Export-Import Bank.
Why should people care about the rules of the Senate? Why does this matter?
If it's possible to believe, if this negotiation wasn't agreed to, the Senate would actually slow down. Critics of the rule changes say that the next step would be to allow filibusters on legislation, just everyday functions, not just presidential appointees or judicial nominees, but also bills, you know, the governing function of the Senate. This, in a way, does affect Alaska. Both of our two senators like to see themselves as middle of the road, as negotiators, as people willing to cut deals. You know, the collegial atmosphere would just be diminished. People would not want to work with the other side.
How did Alaska senators feel about the change?
Senator Murkowski says she has this policy where the president should have the ability to choose his own people. If the president nominates this person to lead that agency, he or she perhaps should have the right to do so. Senator Begich, interestingly, has never been in the minority. Since he got elected to the Senate in 2008, he has always been in the majority. And the people leading this fight are young Democrats, newer Democrats to the Senate, people like Senator Begich, who don't know what it's like to not have power. You know, he says he's okay with the compromise, but he told me he would have been just fine with changing the rules.
They need their team to run these departments. When I was on the local assembly and there was a mayor that I didn't really care for his politics, I voted for almost every single one of his appointments.
In that, Senator Begich saying President Obama deserves to have the people he chooses working for him.
So, Peter, now what? What's next?
Well, the Senate voted to begin debate on Richard Cordray to head the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He won 71 yes votes, including both Senator Murkowski and Begich. And that first vote is always the crucial one that matters. Majority Leader Reid says votes are coming this week on the nominee to lead the EPA, Gina McCarthy. That'll be interesting to see where our two senators vote on that. Senator Murkowski says she thinks she has the 60 votes needed to move on. Senator Begich will be interesting to watch. Obviously, he's up for re-election, and people love to hate the EPA.
All right. Thanks, Peter, for that update.
Thank you.
APRN's Peter Granitz reporting from Washington, D.C. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Galena residents welcome donations of salmon.
First night we got it, we served up a bunch of it, and we had numerous comments. Boy, it's nice to have fish.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
Peter Tony, a 69-year-old Bethel resident and former foster parent, is facing more charges of sexually abusing minors. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
Tony is already in jail on 7 counts of sexual abuse of a minor. Now, a Bethel grand jury indicted him on 3 more similar counts. The first victim was a 4-year-old who was allegedly abused for the span of about a year. This new victim was allegedly abused in 1998. That's the same year that Peter Tony's foster license with his wife Marilyn was revoked by the Office of Children's Services after 14 years of being foster parents. According to Bethel Police, a year prior, a victim had filed allegations of abuse with OCS. OCS hasn't said why the Tonys lost their license in 1998 and say they are looking into the case. After losing their license, the Tonys opened a small in-home daycare, which they ran until a few years ago. Peter Tony's stepdaughter, Kimberly Bruche, has come forward saying she was abused by Tony when she was 8. She's now 48 years old, living in Ketchikan. She says her two sisters, who committed suicide as adults, were also abused by Tony as children. Bruche can't press charges because the statute of limitations has run out for her. All 10 charges against Tony are Class B felonies. Bethel police, who have been investigating the case, say that victims could go back to the 1970s. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Residents in Galena are continuing work toward returning to a normal life. They're rebuilding their homes, and thanks to a joint effort from the Department of Fish and Game and Quick Pack Fisheries, they're also restocking their freezers. KIYU's Jeremy Scott has the story.
During May's Yukon River flood, electricity throughout Galena had to be cut for days. As a result, many people's freezers thawed out and their food rotted. Members of the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association asked the Department of Fish and Game what could be done to help. Fish and Game was running a test fishery at the time and contacted Quick Pack Fisheries in Emonic about processing some summer chum to be sent to Galena. The result was prolific.
Close to 3,000 pounds donated.
That's Galena Interior Learning Academy culinary teacher Rand Rosecrantz, whose dining hall has been used to store that fish. Residents have been able to go to the hall to pick some up to take home.
It's just beautiful fish, and so it's real well-received. I mean, first night we got it, we served up a bunch of it, and we had numerous comments of, well, it's nice to have fish.
Quick Pack normally prices 3,000 pounds of summer chum to a retailer at around $2.50 per pound wholesale. That means approximately $7,500 worth of fish was donated. Quick Pack General Manager Jack Schulteis says in times of crisis, it's community over commodity.
Everybody who lives on this river, it's because of fish, you know. So it's pretty easy to understand the needs. And so it was a kind of a no-brainer thing to do this. But we would certainly send more fish up if they need it.
Schulteis says to this point, none of the other flood-affected villages have voiced a need for fish, and Galena hasn't asked for any more. So for now, Rosecrantz says he'll continue distributing what's left of the fish originally donated, and whether or not more fish comes in, he says he and the rest of the community are already eternally grateful.
Normally, we'd be out fishing, or getting ready to fish, or gathering logs out of the river and practicing subsistence, and for someone to come and give us this fish, which, you know, it's the lifeblood of one of the staples of the diets here on the river. So for someone to come up and just give that to us and to donate it to us, we need to just smile and say thank you. And a lot of people are. They're really happy. They're real pleased that they're able to get fish and start putting fish back in their freezers.
Reporting from Galena, I'm Jeremy Scott.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game issued an emergency order yesterday closing the Chilkoot watershed near Haines to sockeye sport fishing because of low escapements. The Chilkoot sockeye run was forecasted to be low this year, but with just over 4,000 sockeye through the Chilkoot River Weir as of July 14th, the run is turning out to be lower than expected. It is not expected to reach the lower end of the escapement goal of 38,000 fish. Brian Elliott is assistant area biologist for Haines and Skagway.
If all things are equal, if we're tracking average run timing, it's going to end up around 22,000 in the drainage. So that's falling significantly short.
Last year was the largest run of returning sockeye to Chilkoot River and Lake since the weir counts began in 1976. Even so, it's no surprise the run is low this year, Elliott said. This year's parent run in 2008 was also below escapement goals. So far, this is the fifth lowest run on record. It's not the first time an emergency order has gone into place for Chilkoot, Elliott says, and there is still a possibility the order could be lifted if a swell of sockeye eventually arrive.
You know, that's kind of a last resort for us when we feel like we need every fish on the spawning grounds we can get. We'll go ahead and put these measures into place with the expectation that if the counts do improve and it looks like we are going to make the escapement goal, then we will rescind our restrictions in place.
The commercial drift gillnet fleet is also facing restrictions on the Chilkoot side. Commercial fish biologist Randy Bachman said the fishery is in conservation management mode right now, with gear restrictions and a limited area open. Bachman said the subsistence effort is light in the Chilkoot area because of the low escapements. Instead, Fish and Game is encouraging subsistence users to fish the Chilkat side, where sockeye returns are already strong. Elliott said the projection for Chilkat Lake is well within the goal range of 70 to 150,000 fish.
Looking good. Yeah, it's above average in the fish wheels and at the Chilkat Lake Weir. So it's kind of the opposite of last year when we had a robust Chilkoot run and Chilkat was below average.
But the Chilkoot side is popular for sockeye sport fishing, especially among visitors and Canadian fishermen. Elliott says the emergency order does not mean sport fishermen have to quit having fun. They just can't keep any sockeye they catch.
We want them to go out there and have a good time sport fishing. We need the sockeye on the spawning grounds and not in their coolers.
The restriction remains in effect through October 15th, or until the department projects the escapement goal will be met. Former Wrangell Medical Center CEO Noel Selray has been named the interim administrator for the Southeast Regional Health Consortium, or SERCH, Mount Edgecombe Hospital in Sitka. KSDK's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
The news came out in a July 12th press release on the SERCH website. Dr. Marty Grassmeter is the current hospital administrator and medical director at SERCH's Mount Edgecombe Hospital in Sitka. He's worked for SERCH for 19 years and is leaving to take a job in Oregon. The end of his tenure in Sitka will be late September. At that time, Selray will step in as the interim director. SERCH Communications Director Michael Jenkins was not directly involved in the hiring process, but he says he thinks Ray was hired because of his extensive experience in running rural hospitals. Jenkins says that as the interim, Ray's job will not be quite the same as a permanent administrator.
When Noel comes in, he can't do anything that's going to change the operations of the organization. It has to stay status quo.
SERCH states that they do plan to launch a search for a permanent administrator. They plan to begin the search internally, but will expand it nationwide if necessary. Selray was at the center of a controversy at the Wrangell Medical Center after all but one of the hospital board members were recalled. Selray was fired without cause and given a golden handshake. After his firing, he was asked to return a laptop and iPad. The hospital claimed they were company property. As of earlier this year, the hospital's insurance company, Chubb, is paying the city and borough of Wrangell $250,000. A judge and forensics expert are examining the laptop and iPad. They're going to be returning all of the hospital's information. They are not releasing any of Selray's personal information from the two devices. They'll both be destroyed after the examination is finished. Jenkins says he doesn't think this controversy was a deterring factor in Ray's hiring.
The executive team basically has said that really that's an issue that's been between him and the community and of Wrangell, and from what we understand, that's been resolved.
Noel Selray was contacted but declined to comment. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Three overdue hikers have been found safe on the Stampede Trail, according to the Alaska State Troopers. On yesterday morning, state troopers and paramedics from the Tri-Valley Fire Department received a report that Jensen Green of Talkeetna, along with Nate Perkins and Kaya Bridges of Utah, had begun a hike down the Stampede Trail west of Healy on Saturday and were expected to return Sunday. The Stampede Trail is a difficult 20-mile trip each way. It begins at the end of a mining road and passes through often swampy terrain and across the Teklanika River. Today, it is primarily used by hikers attempting to reach the former Fairbanks transit bus at the center of the book and film Into the Wild. In 1992, Christopher McCandless died in the bus after becoming stranded by the rising Teklanika. The troopers and paramedics reached the hikers, who were safe and uninjured. They said they had decided to spend an extra night on the trail because the hike was more tiring than anticipated. Megan Peters, a spokeswoman for the Alaska State Troopers, did not confirm that the hikers were visiting the bus, but says that it is probable. This is the third time that a search or rescue operation has been conducted for hikers on the Stampede Trail this year. On May 27th, three German hikers were rescued by state troopers, and on June 25th, an Army helicopter on a training mission happened upon three hikers who had been stranded by the rising river and run out of food, much like McCandless himself. Officials monitoring the more than 85,000-acre Stewart Creek II fire burning southeast of Fairbanks have lifted an evacuation watch between milepost 16 and 27 along China Hot Springs Road. However, Mark Holland, a spokesman with the Bureau of Land Management's Alaska Fire Service, says an evacuation watch for residents living between milepost 27 and 39 is still in place.
I wouldn't want them to let their guard down. We hope, given the weather forecasting for the rest of this week, we're going to get lower temperatures, we're going to get higher humidities, and possibly some rain showers.
Holland says residents in Two Rivers and Pleasant Valley should remain prepared in the event of an emergency. Nearly 700 firefighters and personnel are still battling the blaze.
It's an admixture of everything there is to fight a fire. There are water tenders, people hauling water to sites where hose lays are down so that crews can put water on the fire or on their fire lines. You have crews that are digging line. You have Caterpillar tractor drivers. You have people feeding kitchen personnel, feeding these folks. Just everything that would need to be there to fight a fire.
Due to dry and windy weather, spot fires have flared up and crossed the South Fork of the Chena River over the last few days. Holland says that kind of activity is expected, but he says fighting spot fires is challenging.
They burn erratically. You don't know. The material came from the main fire and would get superheated, and winds would drive materials like limbs and brush and things like that out ahead of the fire. And they can go a long ways, a surprisingly long ways. And when they hit something flammable, they catch that on fire.
Thick smoke associated with spot fires makes them difficult to fight. Holland says spot fires that are burning in the area are still a good distance from the road. A few spot fires are burning within the state's Chena Recreation Area. One is burning along Martin Creek near the state's Nugget Creek Cabin. Holland says officials with state parks haven't reported any damage, but the fate of the cabin is unclear. Firefighters report the fire about 57% contained. As climate change alters the landscape of the Arctic, more vessel traffic will be arriving in Arctic waters, and the need for sea ice forecasts will be vital. As KNOM's Margaret DeMioribus reports, a UAF professor is trying to improve the current forecast system.
A University of Alaska researcher is urging the scientific community to develop a more efficient method of forecasting sea ice movements. Hayo Eichen is a professor of geophysics at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and says sea ice is dynamic and is affected by both the weather and the ocean temperature and currents. He adds that climate change is an important factor in changing recent distribution of ice. Historically, Eichen says, there was perennial ice cover in the Arctic, meaning only small areas along the margins became ice-free, even in the summertime. Now that sea ice is diminishing in greater capacities, passageways are opening up and concern is growing for how the environment and animals and humans will be affected.
The presence of that ice cover is important for climate because that ice helps cool the planet because it reflects a lot of sunlight back into space. You know, it doesn't allow the temperature in the Arctic to go up very far in the interior Arctic, very far above the freezing point of seawater. It's important, of course, for a range of different animals who use that ice as a platform. And it, among other things, for example, helps protect the shoreline.
Eiken says with the increase of activities in the Arctic, predictions of sea ice forecasts on timescales ranging from several days to several months in advance are becoming increasingly important. However, he says, the numerical models used to forecast short and long-term sea ice cover need improvement.
Right now, there's a range of different approaches that people use, but none of them really in of themselves have been well-studied, well-validated, and that's definitely a key concern.
Eiken adds that research is being done by multiple entities, with about one-third done by foreign countries and the private sector. He says it's not always straightforward to find sea ice data and get access to it.
We could be doing a much better job in planning where we're going to make measurements, who's going to make those measurements, how they're going to be shared, so that we end up with a more complete picture using the least amount of resources for that.
Eiken says in recent years, there has been great progress made in having local experts contribute to different observing networks, including the Arctic Observing Summit that met for the first time this year. He says for collaboration to work well, there needs to be better and more efficient communication between entities.
But really, what we need is to take the best of the information we can get from the models and combine that with the best of information that, for example, local or traditional environmental knowledge provides, which of course is a deep resource of information, combining that with the best of information that just people on the ground can provide as well.
With improved numerical models and collaboration, Eiken says that data from different sea ice forecasts can meet the needs of various groups. In Nome, I'm Margaret DiMaioribus.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Jay Baird in Kodiak, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Jeremy Scott in Galena, Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, Shady Grove Oliver in Wrangell, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, and Margaret DiMaioribus in Nome. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.